You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you back home in D.C., 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our website, and it's amazing. It's amazing. Last night on the train home, Louise and I watched on our various electronic devices the entire Republican debate. It was a nice coincidence. The train ride literally began with the debate and ended with the debate from Amtrak from New York to D.C., and which is very nice. Amtrak has got, you know, they do a good job. It just blows my mind that the Republicans, you know, like Rick Scott, this bozo Republican governor down in Florida, he's saying Obama wants to give us highway funds mass transit funds. In fact, this was, you know, months ago from the stimulus, or years ago, year and a half ago from the stimulus to build a high speed rail. Nah, we're not going to do that. We don't want the money. Yeah, it'll create 30,000-40,000 jobs, but we don't want the jobs. We want to keep people unemployed until November 2012 so that they'll be angry with the president. So, anyhow, right now, the president, President Obama, is out pushing, well, this from the Associated Press, heralding a splash of good news on jobs. President Obama, Barack Obama, on Wednesday, that would be today, praised a series of companies that have promised to hire 25,000 veterans or military spouses within 2 years. You see, he's got this American Jobs Act, and if this thing passes, companies that hire veterans get a substantial tax bonus. I think it's around six grand, something like that. And Tyson Foods, Coca-Cola, others have said that, you know, they're going to hire 25,000 people by the end of 2013. Now, that's not going to help President Obama get elected in 2012, in November 2012. Maybe some of those companies, very conservative companies, will be looking at, okay, we'll do that right after the election. But it doesn't matter. I mean, what he's saying is, you know, the president is talking about jobs. Meanwhile, the Republicans are talking about everything except jobs. The GOP debate last night was hysterical. Here's just a quick 60-second mashup that Jacob Dean, our associate producer, put together this morning.
We want everyone watching to emerge from this debate more informed about the candidates.
I'll bump plans with you, brother.
We have enough weapons to blow up the world about 20, 25 times.
I'm a hawk, but I'm a cheap hawk.
We are replacing the current tax code with oranges. That's apples and oranges.
I'll get you a copy of it so you'll understand it.
Hold on. I need to respond to that.
His turn. Okay, and mine. I haven't had a chance to respond yet because you were interrupting the entire time I was trying to speak.
Rick, you stood here in front of the American people and did not tell the truth. That is an absolute falsehood on its face, man.
Well, this has been a tough couple of debates for Rick, and I understand that. And so you're going to get tested.
Rick,
Would you please wait? Are you just going to keep talking?
Yes,
you're going to let me finish with what I have to say.
And this is one night when I hope what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas.
Yeah, well, actually, Michelle Bachmann, being Michelle Bachmann, she probably hopes nothing that happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. In fact, she probably hopes that half of what happens in Vegas didn't happen in Vegas. But in any case, that was it. That was the GOP debate in 60 seconds, everything you need to know about it. There were actually some pretty amazing spots. This, you know, we've had Republican crowds so far cheer executions. In one case of a man who is probably innocent, certainly a lot of doubt. We've had them cheer executions. We've had them cheer wars. There's just been some bad behavior, shall we say, on the part of Republican crowds. Last night they were cheering, blaming the unemployed for their own fate. Here is Herman Cain.
How do you explain the Occupy Wall Street movement happening across the country? And how does it relate with your message? Herman Cain, I got to ask you, you said, quote, two weeks ago, you said, don't blame Wall Street, don't blame the big banks. If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself. That was 2 weeks ago. The movement has grown. Do you still say that?
Yes, I do still say that. And here's why.
You hear that?
Yeah! If you're out of a job, it's your own damn fault. It's...
Oh, man. Just consider this. You know, McDonald's announced that they were going to hire 60,000 people nationwide. 1 million people showed up. Literally, for every job offered in America right now, there are 5 applicants. And those 5 applicants, in other words, you know, there are 4 times more people looking for jobs than there are jobs, new jobs, available jobs, companies in transition. And I can tell you that, you know, just from our own experience here in Washington, D.C. It's just incredible. I mean, we ran an ad a while ago. This was, I don't know, a month or 3 ago. We were looking for somebody to, you know, grow our staff. And I think Louise must have gotten 200 or thereabouts. It was well over 100 anyway. And this was for a very highly specialized little niche of, you know, you've got to know how to use this machine in this way and this, you know, and not everybody was qualified, obviously, but a good number of them were. And it's just, you know, the economy sucks. And nobody last night was talking about jobs. In fact, this is Ron Paul responding to Herman Cain, was saying, come on.
Well, I think Mr. Cain has blamed the victims. There's a lot of people that are victims of this business cycle. We can't blame the victims, but we also have to point. I'd go to Washington as well as Wall Street, but I'd go over to the Federal Reserve. They create the financial bubbles, and you have to understand that. You can't solve these problems if you don't know where these bubbles come from. But then when the bailout came, and supported by both parties, you have to realize, oh, wait, Republicans were still in charge. So the bailouts came from both parties. Guess who they bailed out? The big corporations, the people who were ripping off the people in the derivatives market. And they said, oh, the world's going to come to an end unless we bail out all the banks. So the banks were involved, and the Federal Reserve was involved. But who got stuck? The middle class got stuck. They got stuck. They lost their jobs and they lost their houses. If you had to give money out, you should have given it to the people who were losing their mortgages, not to the banks.
There you go. Now, Ron Paul is a little, you know, in his passionate dislike of the Fed, which I understand and to a large extent share. He does kind of go over the edge. Because the fact of the matter is that we didn't have bubbles in the United States from 1935 until 1986, basically. We didn't have a bubble economy. There were no, you can't identify bubbles during that period of time. And why? Because the top tax rate on rich people was between 91% and 74%. And so there wasn't all this hot money flooding into Wall Street or flooding into dot-coms or flooding into, you know, name your bubble, right? Real estate. There wasn't all this hot money. There wasn't all this speculation going on. People were, because, you know, the top tax rate was causing rich people to keep their money in their businesses. So it wasn't the Fed that created the bubble. The Fed facilitated the bubble, you know, it gave the banks, you know, the means to leverage that hot money. But it didn't create it. What created it was the Reagan tax cuts. Let's just be clear about that. Let's just be honest about that. Let's be upfront about this. Now, meanwhile, Herman Cain, this is, you know, Herman Cain has just gone off completely off the rails. The entire group last night was going after Herman Cain. We'll tell you about that in a little bit. Also, I want to get back to some of the Occupy movements, what's going on with them. So we will be back in just a moment with a guest from the Occupy. Which one is it? This is Occupy Boston. Stephen Squibb will be with us. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yep, Occupy Boston is next. They have a message for Bernanke.
Said I think I'll go to Boston. I think I'll start a new life. I think I'll start it over. No one knows my name.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Stephen Squibb with OccupyBoston.com on the line with us. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And from inside a tent? Is that
yes, we're actually we're inside our library tent here at Occupy Boston. It's a bit of a rainy day, so we're just sitting here catching up on our reading.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Now, I understand Ben Bernanke's coming to town.
He was here yesterday, actually.
Okay.
I gave a speech across the street. Did not think it was necessary to come over and talk to us, but we made our thoughts known, and we also gave him some questions, which we're still waiting on answers for. So we'll see.
What were your thoughts that you made known to him, and what were the questions you want answered by the Fed or by the chairman of the Fed?
There was a number of them, actually. And, you know, I want to say here at the beginning, Tom, that I'm just a volunteer here at Occupy Boston. I don't speak for the movement. I can speak of it. But I just want to put that out there that all these things are sort of my own thoughts and recollections. And
you're speaking for yourself.
Yes, exactly. So we had a couple questions. One was, why does he oppose the reinstitution of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separates commercial and sort of non-commercial banking?
Does he oppose that? Do you know that for a fact?
I have heard that, yes.
Okay.
He has said numerous times the Fed has done all it can do, and that it's really up to the sort of legislature and the president to take action on the economy.
Right.
And we're curious what he thinks that action should be. You know, his predecessor at the Fed was a devotee of Ayn Rand.
Right.
I think we're sort of reaping the whirlwind that caused, but we don't really know what Bernanke's actual prescriptions would be. And I think for someone in his position, with his experience and his power, he owes it to us to tell us what he thinks the government actually should be doing.
Okay. I agree. And so those were basically your statements and your questions.
Yeah, we gave a little talk across the street to assembled folks and put those out there. And we also had a number of good folks from the media down asking us what we thought. And so we actually wrote the Wall Street Journal that, and they put it up on their website. So
it's like a teach-in
out there.
It's like a teaching. Just a real quick recap, Steve. We're talking with Stephen Squibb. He's the media liaison for Occupy Boston, but speaking for yourself?
Just a volunteer.
Just a volunteer.
Working communication.
Yeah. Okay, great. And just give us a snapshot of what's going on with Occupy Boston. You know, who's there? Where are you? How's it going? How are your relations with the local authorities?
It's going incredibly, Tom. It's really something unlike anything I've ever experienced before in my life. We have people here from all walks of life, both in the camp and actually in the tent right now. And it's growing every day. Every day we have more and more people coming down and asking what they can do to help. In terms of relations with the authorities, you know, we did have 141 arrests last week, they were perhaps a little bit rougher than they had to be. But other than that, I really should say that in general, our relations have been very positive. We've received a lot of support from local communities, and also from the patrolmen who keep us safe have been really lovely. So I really think that one.
They are the 99% too.
They certainly are, and I think that's not a message that's getting out enough. You know, when we win, hopefully we can help them too.
Yeah, we all win. Now, what have you learned or would you like us to know about Occupy Boston?
I think a number of things. You know, I would start by saying this is something you really can't understand unless you've come down and seen it for yourself. And that if anyone, you know, there's a lot of conversation about, what is it, are there demands, are there sort of things that people want? And I think the first thing I would say is that we want people to come down and talk to us and talk to each other. And I think that's the stage that this movement's at right now. We're finding each other. We're finding what it is people care about. We're finding it's oftentimes a similar set of issues. And that's really the message right now. The demand is get down here. You know, that's our demand.
Yeah. And that's a good one. Stephen, brilliant work, and keep it up. Please give our very, very best regards to everybody there at Occupy Boston, and thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. OccupyBoston.com, by the way, the website.
And, that's right.
And, great. Thank you, Stephen. And that was Stephen Squibb. Pretty amazing. An update on Occupy San Francisco. Paul in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Morning. Just checking in with you. We're in the mode of survival at this point. A police arrested a couple of nights ago, came in and arrested five. Two were injured. We're really desperately trying to stay dry and stay camped in the at the Federal Reserve in San Francisco on Market Street. We have expanded from 40 campers, up to about 200 now.
I understood you were in a park, I'm forgetting the name of it, near the Embarcadero.
Justin Herman Park.
Justin Herman
Park.
Where
we expanded. It's a block down the street.
Yeah.
It's a public park. We've asked for a permit. The city has, told us that we can't, get a permit because, there's no overnight permits. Mm. So we're stuck in a bureaucratic limbo.
Right.
At this point, and we're just hunkering down, just trying to stay afloat.
I would submit that your permit is called the First Amendment of the United States.
Yeah, so that's where we're at. We're at First Amendment. We're staying put. We're not going anywhere, and we have public support that's overwhelming. All of the Board of Supervisors are refusing to support the police action. They've had a meeting last night. We had probably 2 hours of comments. Every single comment was in support of the San Francisco, Occupy San Francisco action. Yeah. And we're just staying put. It's just right now a matter of our rights versus what the mayor wants. And he's running for office. He's going to have an election in 2 weeks, and people aren't happy with him.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And Occupy and the Board of Supervisors is basically the city council, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
So,
half of them are running for mayor. It's an interesting time in San Francisco right now.
No doubt about
it. Where we are across from the ferry building, I don't know if you know where that is, but the heart of the commerce of San Francisco.
Yeah.
They've rented out the public park for 3 months to a private company.
Paul, we're out of time, but thank you. Thank you for the report.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. More. I'd like to share a few more thoughts from the twilight zone of last night's debate with you. Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Uh-oh, our Twilight Zone alert. Another week, another chance of getting hit by a falling satellite. This time it's a German satellite about the size of a minivan that is plummeting toward Earth and could strike our planet by Friday. The retired Rosat satellite was launched in 1990. It orbits the planet once every 90 minutes. This thing is really flying. But scientists recently lost contact with it. So far they have no idea where it's going to land. But they've released odds on it hitting a person somewhere in the world at 2,000 to 1. About the same odds Newt Gingrich has of winning the Republican nomination. Yeah, thank you. Speaking of the Republican nomination, this is clip number 4. This is where Romney and Perry get into this thing back in the 1980s. This is kind of a good news, bad news story for Mitt Romney. The bad news is that, you know, as it sinks into average people, average voters, that this is a guy who's worth somewhere between $200 and $400 million and has 7 major estates around the country and around the world. And actually, maybe it's 5, but whatever it is. And, you know, his houses are so big and his lawns are so big. He, you know, this is a guy who doesn't go out and mow his lawn, right? It's like, this is kind of like the George Herbert Walker Bush moment when he walked through the supermarket. He says, wow, look at that scanner. That's so cool. Wow, technology. And the woman was like, yeah, we've had these for 10 years, sir. You know, obviously he'd never bought anything. I have people who do that. You know, it's like the private jet crowd, right? So, you know, Mitt Romney's very much one of those private jet crowds. One of these guys who, you know, never goes through public airports and never mows his own lawn. And so back in the 2008 election, it came out that he had, you know, they walked up to some of the people mowing his lawn and got their IDs, figured out who they were, and figured out that they were illegals. And so it, you know, became a little minor scandal for a few minutes that Mitt Romney had illegal guys mowing his lawn. And so Mitt Romney says, I didn't hire those guys. I hired an American company, a contractor, a local contractor in Massachusetts, who is an American, and said, get my lawn mowed. And he hires people who are illegals. And when the newspaper outed the fact that they were illegal, he said, I told the guy, the contractor, you know, I don't want illegal people mowing my lawn. And so they, you know, put a stop to it. And then about a year later, another newspaper reporter walked up to somebody mowing Mitt Romney's lawn. And I don't know, maybe it was a different contractor or time had passed or whatever. But, you know, the contractor was back to using illegals to mow Mitt Romney's lawn. And so he got embarrassed again and he stopped it again. So, you know, it's like it's kind of a story that's a non-story. But Rick Perry thought he had Mitt Romney by the short hairs here. And, you know, on this, you know, what, three-year-old story that was a non-story, that was a one-day event. And what this demonstrates, I think, more than anything else, is how desperate Rick Perry is right now. And all the second-tier candidates. I mean, if there was a word for the one word that capsulizes last night's Republican debate, it was desperation. Here's Rick Perry and Mitt Romney.
I got 30 seconds, and we got to move on to another immigration question.
You had an op-ed, Ed, in the newspaper saying you're open to amnesty. That's number one. Number two, we hired a lawn company to mow our lawn, and they had illegal immigrants that were working there. And when that was pointed out to us, we let them go. And we went to them and said, you have a problem with allowing someone to finish speaking. And I suggest that if you want to become president of the United States, you got to let both people speak. So first, let me speak. So we went to the company and we said, look, you can't have any illegals working on our property. I'm running for office, for Pete's sake. I can't have illegals. It turns out that once again, they hired someone who had falsified their documents, had documents, and therefore we fired them.
Yeah. So there's actually, for me, several take home messages from this. As I said, the first one, you know, Mitt Romney is part of the top. He's part of the 1%. You know, he not only does he not mow his own lawn, he doesn't let the dog drive in the car. He ties it to the roof. number one. Number two, he says, hey, I can't have illegals working for me. I'm running for office. So in other words, if he's not running for office, it's just fine to have people working for you who are undocumented and therefore in almost all probability being exploited by their employers. And then number three, the number three take-home message that I got from that clip, and I don't know if you were listening carefully enough. I probably should have pointed it out beforehand. But there was a big cheer for Mitt Romney when he put down Rick Perry, when he said, you know, if you want to run for president, you got to learn to listen, or you got to learn to let the other guy speak. As you know, and the context of that, I'm sure, had he elaborated, would be, you know, if you're going to engage in diplomacy with other, you know, whatever. And he got a huge cheer from the audience for that. In large part because Nevada is a Mitt Romney state. Now, why is Nevada a Mitt Romney state? Because Nevada has a huge Mormon population. Harry Reid's a Mormon. I mean, Nevada elects Mormons. There's a lot of Mormons in Nevada. They migrated out of Salt Lake City, and Mormon Church, the Church of the Latter-day Saints, not the crazy branches, the polygamist, but the mainline Mormon Church is the fastest-growing church in the United States. And part of it is that in order to become a priest in the church, which every man has to be before he gets married or when he gets married or whatever, and keep in mind, I'm not representing myself as an authority on Mormonism. This is what authorities have said on this program. So, you know, fact check it. But this is my understanding. In order to become an adult and therefore a full member of the church, which also makes you a priest, you have to do your time as an evangelist. You see these kids walking down the street wearing white shirts and skinny black ties and slacks, and they all look like they just stepped right out of 1955, and they're Mormon missionaries. And the church sends them all over the world, but you basically got to do, you know, it's like a draft. And that's a large part, that and you know, and some practices and teachings that, frankly, our family, as is the case with many churches, are, you know, frankly, help build families, bring people together for people who have to have some sort of a structure or a crutch or a community and can't otherwise find it. And again, I don't want to be boosting Mormonism or any organized religion, frankly. I think they are all cults, all organized religions. As I've said before, don't come knocking on my door, whether you're Christian, an atheist, or whatever. You know, if your religion is atheism, if your religion is Christianity, if your religion is Mormonism, And I know that there are Mormons who say it's Christianity. That's fine. I'm not, you know, I don't want to get in that fight. Just don't bring it to my front door. But I thought that was interesting. And this is a this fact that Nevada has so many Mormons and who will get out and go. I mean, you know, they look at what they did with what was it called? Prop 5, I think, in California, the anti-gay rights, you know, repeal gay rights legislation in the state of California. That ultimately, you know, got blown up by the courts. But it was the Mormon church based out of Salt Lake City that and Mormons, large Mormon donors who put up, you know, if news reports are correct, as much as half of the money for that and who manned huge phone banks and huge door to door efforts across the state of California to pass a law saying that their legalization of gay marriage should be repealed. So the Mormons know how to get politically active. And when they've got a guy at the top of the ticket, they're going to do it. Howard, in Atascadero, California, listening on KYNS. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Hey, thanks, Tom, for taking my call. You referred yesterday to expression of betrayal of trust. What my item is, it ought to fit into that perfectly. I'm an independent voter here, and I have an idea on how to put the Republican Conservative Teabag Party on the defensive right now and going toward the 2012 congressional elections.
Mm-hmm.
And let's start identifying the 100 teabag congressmen and their lack of cooperation and compromise in settling the debt crisis and help upending the world's financial markets by swearing allegiance to Grover Norquist and his no-tax policy. Now, this
it's not just the teabaggers who did that. Virtually every Republican in the House and Senate has signed Grover Norquist, you know, has sworn allegiance to Grover Norquist rather than or in addition to.
Right.
But I think they conflict the U.S. Constitution.
Right. We'll identify them all. This oath to Grover Norquist, a lobbyist and, an unelected lackey of corporate America,
creates
a pattern of treason or betrayal of trust by his usurping the Congress sacred pledge to uphold the Constitution of the United States.
Yep. Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Aren't Congress supposed to represent the people and not a dictator like Norquist?
Well, Norquist isn't a dictator. He's a lobbyist, as you correctly identified. And this is the bizarre part, is that any member of Congress should be taking an oath to a lobbyist as opposed to taking an oath to their constituents. I mean, you would think that if a member and you know, I suppose there's probably even a few Democrats who've signed this, but by and large, the Democrats look at this and I think you got it absolutely right, Howard. The Democrats look at this and they go, wait a minute. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution. I was sworn in as a member of Congress. I'm here for my people. And now you, Grover Norquist, a high-paid multimillionaire lobbyist, you want me to take an oath to you? Are you serious?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, is it legal to arrest someone at an Occupy Wall Street movement or an Occupy movement because an umbrella can be used as a tent? Okay, here's my theory of what's going on around the country. From the law enforcement side, from the establishment side, from the governmental side, it's not even the governmental side. It's the power structure side. You know, I lack the words. Or maybe there's too many words. But basically, the banksters are trying to figure out, and the police are trying to figure out, how can we get rid of this pesky Occupy movement? And I think that they're doing the equivalent of market testing around the country. They're trying out different tactics. My guess is ultimately what they're going to do is they're going to start, you know, nailing all these groups with court challenges, and then ultimately some, you know, judge will rule and it'll go to a federal judge and they'll say, yes, you know, this is illegal, camping out without a permit or whatever zoning laws are legal. I'll pull zoning laws, and then, you know, everybody will be declared a lawbreaker and kicked out. And I think that part of that testing process is being tried out in different cities in different ways, and that Seattle was part of it. It's just my theory, my personal conspiracy theory. Mark Taylor Canfield is with us. He's a member of the Occupy Seattle Working Group. OccupySeattle.org is their website. And, Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be on.
It's great to have you with us. I understand that you guys now, you know, Louise and I lived in the Pacific Northwest for nearly five years, and the rainy season has begun. So if you're going to occupy something overnight, and especially as, you know, through in the Pacific Northwest, instead of getting winter snow like most of the rest of the country, you get winter rain most of the winter. You can't sleep in the rain. I mean, that's very, very cold rain. You die of hypothermia. You've got to protect yourself from it somehow. And apropos of that, apparently the Seattle police, did they really bust somebody because they said that an umbrella was the equivalent of a tent or a shelter?
Well, at this point, they're saying that structures are not allowed. So however you interpret that particular word, they interpreted an umbrella as a structure, which I guess would include anything that could provide shelter at this point. And, I mean, it comes across very much as if there's some kind of political repression going on, because you've got people that are committed to being there 24 hours a day, just like and all of these other occupations across the country. And unlike some other towns like Portland, where they're allowed to have tents, in Seattle, not only are people not allowed to have any kind of shelter, but they're continually told that anyone in the park after 10 o'clock is subject to arrest. And basically what's been happening is we had at one point about 150 tents there, and they were all confiscated or pushed out of the park. Mm-hmm. I personally lost my tent. They were confiscated by the Parks Department. So people are down there now, and people like me catching colds and getting ill because, yeah, it's getting down into the 30s at night here now in Seattle. And then for anyone who's ever been to Westlake Park, you know that there is no grass down there. It's all a town square sort of situation where it's all really cold stone. It's very difficult to sleep on without any padding, but the police won't even let people fall asleep down there. I mean, even if you're sitting on a bench and you start to fall asleep, they'll come along and try to wake you up. They shine their spotlights into the crowd, into our eyes so that we can't see anything. They turn on their flashing lights. They make announcements, you know, that anyone in the park after 10 will be arrested, even though generally that's not been happening because there's up to 100 people, sometimes more, there all night long. And it seems like selective enforcement to me.
Yeah, yeah. Are you? First of all, do you think that you and the folks there are going to hang in? Are you finding an influx? Are more and more people showing up in Seattle? What's the name of the park? Where is it located?
It's called Westlake Park. It's actually right in the middle of the downtown shopping district in Seattle at 4th and Pine.
Okay, I know where that is.
It was actually the spot where 350 people were arrested during the anti-WTO demonstrations back in 1999 for being in that park. So it's got there's a historic precedent of First Amendment rights being violated there.
Yeah.
And we're maintaining that that's what's happening now. And what's particularly confusing is that our own mayor, Democrat Mike McGinn, has made public statements and posted letters saying that he supports protests against Wall Street, and also our own prosecuting attorney Pete Holmes has been down there wearing buttons that say, you know, Occupy Seattle, and yet they continue to prosecute people who try to put up tents. And every once in a while someone just decides, you know what, it's cold, we're going to put up a tent, and they're immediately arrested and the tent is taken away. Mm-hmm. There's a huge police presence down there. Sometimes they have as many as 18 to 20 squad cars lining the streets. The police walk through the camp, waking people up, shining flashlights in their faces, just generally, you know, trying to wear us down is the way it looks.
Yeah, I would think that that's probably it. Winter's coming, and not just in Seattle, but all across the country. And I've heard more than one right-winger express the sentiment that's what's going to take down the movement. And I'm skeptical about that. I'm very skeptical about that.
Well, people are very committed, and regardless of how the mayor has tried to capitalize politically on our movement, and despite the fact that he's actually tried to get people to move down to City Hall, we've always maintained that we want to occupy that park because it's the most visible place in town for us. And the restrictions that would be placed upon us if we moved to City Hall would be very difficult. They would require us to have our tents down by 6 a.m. every morning. There would be no rallied or permitted rallies down there.
Right.
So basically, it might be a place where people could pitch a tent at night, but it's definitely not a place where we want to have the occupation. Now, also, you know, we would like to add, I think, you know, and I can't speak for everyone in the Occupy Seattle group, of course, but the majority of people there didn't come out on the streets to demonstrate against the mayor or struggle with the police over tents. We came down there to stand in solidarity with the folks in New York City who are standing against Wall Street.
Right. Yeah. And that's such an important point to make. Mark Taylor Canfield, OccupySeattle.org. Thank you, Mark.
Hey, please, you know, go to our website.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. In the first hour, I shared with you, Louise and I watched the Republican debate last night so that you wouldn't have to, save you the pain and heartache of literally watching people cheer for Herman Cain saying, if you're poor and unemployed, it's your own fault, blame yourself. I kid you not. We'll share it with you a little later on. And Herman Cain, apples and oranges. We'll revisit a few of these things. And in fact, there's some clips that I didn't even get to in the first hour of the program that I want to share with you. And meanwhile, Social Security is rolling on. It's going to be fine until 2027, and from then until infinity, it'll pay 80% of benefits. That's assuming that the cap doesn't get raised on it. If the cap gets raised, of course, everything's fine. But the Republicans have their own suggestion for this. Congressman Thaddeus McCotter, the Republican, has a couple of days ago proposed legislation to change, basically to privatize Social Security, to go with the Chilean model or a variation on it. And Peter Ferrara, who is a senior fellow on entitlement and budget policy at the Heartland Institute, heartland.org is their website. And the Twitter, Heartland, I-N-S-T. Peter is strongly of the opinion that that's a great idea. I don't want to be putting words in your mouth, Peter, but is that accurate?
Absolutely. The experience in Chile was that working people gained enormously from that the freedom to choose a personal account, and nearly 100% of workers made the choice. And
well, that's because in 1981, the military dictator, Augusto Pinochet, shut down the public program. They had no choice.
They did have a choice. Each worker individually, one by one, had the choice. And 95%
the choices that they had was among the different the programs are called AFPs, Administratio de Fondos de Pensiones.
That's not the only choice they had. They had a choice to stay with the old system if that's what they wanted.
But they could no longer pay into it.
Made the choice for the personal accounts because the personal accounts paid higher benefits but required only half the payments because they earn real market investment returns. The public system is just based on tax and redistribution and doesn't make any investments at all.
Well, here's a summary from the Chilean government. In 1981, the Chilean government under Augusto Pinochet took the step of phasing out that country's troubled publicly funded Social Security program and mandating participation in a system of privately managed individual accounts.
No, they didn't mandate the participation. They gave each worker individually a choice. 95% of the workers chose the personal accounts. That's one experience is why the chief actuary of Social Security scored McCotter's proposal with the assumption that 100% of workers would choose the personal accounts because they're so obviously a better deal.
Okay, so now Chile, when they made their transition to these private accounts and they phased out the public accounts, they had to pay for that. There was an enormous cost, and in fact, right now our OMB is saying if we did something like Chile, it would cost us $6.9 trillion to make that transition. In other words, to continue paying for people who are in the old system while it is withering and dying, and administer it and all that kind of thing, but it no longer has any income because everybody's moved to the new system. Chile had that same problem, and they did a five-step thing. They cut social expenditures, including health and education spending. They laid off tens of thousands of teachers. They cut healthcare programs. They introduced a value-added tax to pay for this. They raised taxes. They cut lifetime benefits that were required, you know, Social Security. They sold off government assets, including government buildings, and they issued debt. And in fact, 40% of the annual costs for this thing were the result of debt. Are you recommending that the United States do the same thing?
What they did in Chile is they financed half of it by cutting government spending and half of it by borrowing. But under the McCotter bill, they financed it entirely by cutting government spending.
Okay, so you want to take the Chilean part of laying off teachers and firefighters and folks like that, and that's what we should do here in the United States. We should cut the government spending part.
If they did this, that would create jobs because there are mighty rivers of savings and investment going into those personal accounts, which are going through those personal accounts right into the economy today. So that would create jobs and bid up wages, so it actually would benefit the economy enormously today.
Okay, well, two questions for you, Peter. Number one, you're right. It will create jobs because with the AFPs, what do they call them in Chile?
It's a Spanish term.
Administración de Fondos de Pensiones.
Right.
They have gone from none to thousands of them, and they're competing with each other. And as a result of that, they have to pay sales staff, they have to cover marketing expenses, they fiercely compete. The upshot of these is that 50% of all the people who are enrolled in Chile's system, old system, and now they're bringing back the original Social Security program, by the way. Michelle Bachelet brought this back.
And
they're transitioning back into a federal program.
That's inaccurate.
But the upshot of this is that 50% of all Chileans switch programs at least once a year. And when you look at the returns, for example, the average rate of return on accounts from, say, 1992 to 1986 was 15.9%. Pretty good, huh? Pretty good rate of return. But after you take out the commissions, because these are all private for-profit companies, basically what you're suggesting is that we should do with our Social Security the same thing we do with our health insurance, hand it off to for-profit companies, that 15.9% return becomes 0.3%. From 1991 to 1995, they averaged 12.9% return, but after you take out the management fees, it was 2.1%.
What's your source for that?
My source for that is a series of documents, actually, from the Chilean government that you'll find over at the Economic Opportunity Institute's website.
Economic Opportunity Institute?
Yes, sir.
What is that? Because that's completely inaccurate. They earned far higher returns in those accounts than even I or any advocate of personal accounts would ever dare suggest could be earned. Over the 30 years that's been in operation.
Okay.
That's why they are enjoying twice the benefits under this.
This is actually, this came from the Congressional Budget Office from a paper titled Social Security Privatization, Experiences Abroad.
Yeah, well, I challenge that. I challenge that as the source. I don't.
It was published in January of 1999. I recommend you check it out.
Says that because that is not remotely accurate. It's a gross distortion.
In fact, according to the Congressional Budget Office, they said that looking at the Chilean program, they said for a new worker enrolling in 1996, the 3.5% gross yield actually amounted to a minus 6.8% return after taking management fees into account. But the other concern that I have...
I dispute that CBO said that. I'm disputing that they said that. Because they've earned twice the benefits under this account while paying half under the personal account system while paying half what was required under the old system.
Well, okay, here's my two questions.
In Chile than any government program in America.
How can any system where they're skimming 15-20% off the top to pay
they
for
they don't skim 15-20% over
they,
the top.
Their management fees
and under McCotter
are averaging
bill,
between 15-20%. Just like they are with the healthcare industry in the United States.
Under McCotter's
only
bill,
here it's even more.
We designed it so the administrative costs would be negligible. It would be virtually no administration.
So you're not going to allow companies to compete for your money.
They compete. Look, we designed it. I worked with Bill Shipman, the former principal of State Street Global Advisors. He designed.
Okay, last question, Peter. We just have a minute left. Pardon my interrupting you, but I want to get. I'd love to hear your answer to this question. A genuine question. How is it that putting money into Wall Street creates jobs for anybody? Because that money doesn't go to the corporations. It simply goes to the last holder of that stock.
The money goes into savings and investment, and savings and investment is what creates jobs.
How?
So if it's a
if I buy 1,000 shares of General Electric stock, I'm buying it from some guy who's selling 1,000 shares of General Electric stock. How does that create any jobs anywhere?
Savings and investment is what creates jobs. Without
how?
Savings and investment, you don't have any jobs. That's why we're not having any jobs now.
How? If I buy 1,000 shares of GE stock, I realize a stockbroker is going to take
a
commission off the top.
This is the most fundamental principle of economics, that savings and investment is what creates jobs. And
you
ask me how?
If you're talking about IPOs, if you're talking about IPOs where the money is actually going to the company,
when you buy
I would not disagree with you.
If you buy stock from one guy, what is that guy who gets the money, what does he do with it?
If he's a stock speculator, he's going to buy some other stock.
Yeah, so it goes so then it goes to the economy. So just like when you put the money in the bank lends it to somebody. So when you buy the stock, then the guy you bought the stock from has money to invest somewhere else.
So that's our new economy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Peter Ferreira, heartland.org is the website. Peter, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. Just for the record, by the way, just a couple of things. Number one, another thing that the Congressional Budget Office points out is that Herman Cain is so fond of the Chilean model, right, where they basically privatized their Social Security program in 1981 when Augusto Pinochet, the brutal, murderous, ultimately convicted of crimes against humanity dictator of Chile, brought in the Chicago Boys. They brought in the economists. Milton Friedman himself was an advisor to the dictator. And suggested, hey, privatize your Social Security system. Let the free market do its magic. And it cost them a fortune. And so not only did they mandate that people move into these programs and that workers have to deposit 13.3% of their monthly pay into these private accounts, but the government also mandated that all employers had to increase everybody's pay wherever they were on the pay scale by 18% so that people would have enough money to pay into these things. Which, of course, produced inflation over the short term. I mean, I'm all in favor of increasing minimum wage, for example. Frankly, I think it should go up significantly, but not like that. So anyhow, just to wrap up our last my debate with Peter Ferrara in our last hour. Right now, Gene Ross, with the co-president of National Nurses United, is with us. And on the ground with a med tent at the Occupy Wall Street. This is in New York. NationalNursesUnited.org, by the way. Gene?
Yes, nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us, and great to have you back with us. So tell us what's going on there. What are the National Nurses United up to with Occupy Wall Street?
Well, we, of course, are in solid support of the group out there. We had started with our own protest at the end of June and hooked up with some of the people who eventually started Occupy Wall Street, and we've been supporting them since. We set up a tent last week and made that our first eight tent, and we have been staffing it with our nurses from across the country, and we've been busy attending to people that are ill, some of it from sleeping, out in the elements. We've been very busy there. Now, Monday, they tried to take our tent down, New York City officials. And Jesse Jackson came down and with others linked arms with us, and we barred them from tearing the tent down.
Wow. When Mayor Bloomberg backed down.
Yes, that's part. And then Jesse Jackson returned the next day, and then he walked and made rounds with us, so to speak, all the places there, and the nurses were able to restock and get supplies in order.
That's remarkable. So the Occupy Wall Street movement in Manhattan is moving along just fine. The mayor's girlfriend, who's on the board of the company, this giant multi-billion, whatever it is, dollar company that owns the park, has not had their way, apparently. Do I have that right?
So far.
So
far. That's right. That's
yeah.
Correct.
So the top 1% billionaire mayor and his girlfriend, who's on the board of the company that owns the park, so far you all have backed them down, and National Nurses United is providing medical services to people at Occupy Wall Street in New York City. Are you doing it in any other cities?
Yes, we are in several of them, and I don't have all the cities for you right now. In some of the cities, like where I live in Minneapolis, there is the Occupy Minnesota group has already set up their own first aid tents, and we are just helping them. It isn't necessarily one that we set up. But that's one of the things we're doing. Some of them are we're just delivering supplies and serving food, any way in which we can be of service, because we're all in it together.
Yeah.
We're working really hard in preparation for our action in Washington, D.C., November 3rd, because that's meant to coincide with the G20 meeting in France on the same day. Mm-hmm. And we're pushing for our financial transaction tax, which is so necessary and for which we have such global support right now.
Wow. National health care for Occupy Wall Street. That's or universal health care, free universal health care for the Occupy Wall Street folks. Keep it up. That's absolutely great. And of course, National Nurses United has also been working for you have actually a special connection to Wall Street, shall we say. That's probably not quite the right word. But tell us about the campaign that National Nurses United has been waging for quite some time. I mean, you've been on this program, you've been on our TV program, not you specifically, but, I think you have before as well, but others also, about this. Tell us about this.
Well, we have what we call our Main Street Contract Campaign for America. We found so many of our friends, family, and their patients all talking about all the things we know are going on now, the foreclosures, not being able to stay well, not being able to, getting sick because they're there's no home to go to. People can't afford their medications. We have always been in support of a single-payer health care system. We know that it's the only one that will ever work. And if people are so focused on the money, it's the only one that will save us money.
Right.
So we looked at the kinds of things that we know all people in this country should have, including everyone that would be a patient at some point in their lives, right, including ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We all deserve health care. We all deserve a quality public education. We need a secure retirement free from stress of worrying about where our next meal would come from. We deserve a roof over our head. We deserve jobs, the dignity of work.
Yeah, you're talking about Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights. But in the 30 seconds we have left, how is National Nurses United suggesting we implement this?
Well, the first thing we're going to start with, since everyone says we're broke, we have no money, is this financial transaction tax, the 0.5% on the riskiest of the speculation that the Wall Street traders do. We can start with that.
Right, a speculation tax.
And then move forward to the other things.
Yeah, and extract some of that money back out of Wall Street that is being basically recycled for the benefit of billionaires and high-frequency traders and nobody else.
Right. We need it for our populace. It's as simple as that. The money is there. It's in the hands of fewer and fewer people, and the American people need it.
Yep. Amen. Well said. Jean Ross, registered nurse with National Nurses United. She is the co-president of National Nurses United. The website, nationalnursesunited.org. Get over there, check it out. And Jean, kudos to you for the great work you're doing with Occupy Wall Street.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So is it apples or oranges that Herman Cain wants us to, or wants to take away from us? Or what? I don't.
Imagine there's no pizza. I couldn't if I tried. Eating all the tacos or Kentucky Fried. Imagine all these burgers.
Instead of running for president, maybe he should run for the guy who sings the national anthem, you know, at the, I don't know that we, that's sports events, isn't it? You know, yeah, this was Herman Cain, of course, who was just singing that song. Crazy alert for the day. Looks like the Occupy Wall Street haters, that is the people who hate the Occupy Wall Street folks, are getting desperate. The right-wing blogosphere caught fire yesterday over claims that Occupy demonstrators are anti-Semitic Nazis. Why? Because people are wearing Twitter hashtags on their clothes that, according to one blogger from the right-wing website Pajamas Media, resembles swastikas. One of the bloggers wrote, don't these people see an echo of the swastika in their new power symbol? Don't they realize that the early Nazi party was also overtly anti-capitalist? Don't they know that the early Nazis tried to garner sympathy with street rallies and marches? End of quote. Again, we're talking about a hashtag symbol, you know, the old pound sign, like on your phone. The same symbol that's in front of every trending topic on Twitter and in the bottom right-hand corner of your telephone dial. Did you know your phone may be a Nazi communication device? Did you know tic-tac-toe is a secret Nazi game? Because the game board is, of course, a hashtag. Of course, the real question here is, are Republicans Satan worshippers? After all, the stars on their party logo are upside down, a clear sign of the devil. I'm actually not joking about that one. The Republicans actually did that. They flipped it upside down. Hey, breaking news. Holy bailout is one of the top five threads over at Democratic Underground. Federal Reserve now backstopping $75 trillion of Bank of America's derivatives. Keep in mind, first of all, I heard the statistic this morning. J.P. Morgan Chase has $2.2 or $2.7 trillion, between $2 and $3 trillion in assets. The entire gross domestic product of the United States right now is a little under $15 trillion. One bank, $2 trillion. More than $2 trillion. But here's where it gets even weirder. The Bank of America, which is in large part actually owned by a Saudi prince, but the Bank of America has $75 trillion worth of derivatives out there. They're still out there. Wells Fargo has $73 trillion out there. Keep in mind, the GDP of the entire planet is $65 trillion. The GDP of the United States is $15 trillion. Each of these banks has over $70 trillion worth of derivatives, and they are in their investment bank branches, which are not backstopped by the FDIC. And what did they do over the last couple of days? And this is what Bloomberg is talking about. They moved them into their commercial banking arms, since now it's all one bank, since we did away with Glass-Steagall, which is protected by both the FDIC and backstopped by the Fed. So now you and I and the Fed are officially backstopping, as far as we know. And, you know, these are only two of the six banks that own assets equal to 65% of the entire GDP of the United States. But just with these two banks, you and I, via the Fed, are now backstopping $150 trillion worth of bets on bets on bets on bets on bets about mortgages and other things. The entire gross domestic product of our country. $15 trillion, and we're backstopping $150 trillion? Wall Street still has us by the neck. This is amazing. I don't know how to say it other than that. It's amazing. By the way, the next chapter, it actually happened yesterday, but I was out of town and I didn't notice it. Over at truthout.org, they are serializing my book, Unequal Protection. That's the book. If you saw me on Dylan Radigan's show yesterday on MSNBC, I was reading an old Wisconsin law rather loudly from one of my books, and it was from Unequal Protection. And that book is being serialized over at truthout.org. We're giving the entire book away online for free, one chapter every week. And then when they're all done, they'll all be up there, just like we did before with Rebooting the American Dream, which is also, the entire book is there for free. You can read it online. That one has already been serialized. This one we're about three quarters of the way done. And this week's chapter, Unequal Influence. There are politicians who work on behalf of corporations, and there are politicians who work on behalf of humans. So you can check that out over at truthout.org. I think you may find it interesting. Larry in Kalmar, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hey, Larry.
Yeah, well, I took a month off from my PhD studies at Tom Hartman University and went fishing. And
sounds relaxing.
And, yeah, it was
except nice. For the fish.
Okay, yeah, they troubled them a little bit.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, the People's Revolution began.
Mm-hmm.
and, you know, occupy D.C. and Wall Street and stuff. And finally, the people are taken to the streets worldwide.
Yep.
To bring economic justice to this earth.
Yes.
I mean, it's been going on since, like, Egyptian times, that a small group of elites have pretty much controlled all the money. And
I'd say it's been going on since, you know, Daniel Quinn has this theory that it all began with agriculture, when somebody figured out that that there were times of the year when there wasn't food being produced and times of the year when there was, and that somebody could lock up the food, and thus you had the first rich person, the first person who figured out how to lock up the food for the winter.
Yeah,
and dole it out to people. So and that was about 10,000 years ago. And I agree with his theory. He lays it out in Ishmael and My Ishmael and a couple of other of his books.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's like the eighth wonder of the world that 1% of the people can control all the money. But you know, I think this is over the next couple of years. This is going to change the world.
I think so too. I think that this is a revolutionary moment. And I can't speak for the world, although I suspect, you know, typically the world seems to kind of follow what we're up to. There were no democracies before the American Revolution, and you know, by the Civil War there were about five, and now there's, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of between 80 and 120, depending on how you define democracies. So I think as the United States is transformed, so is the world. And if we get our act together, if we learn the proper lessons from this, if we go through this transformational period well and healthily, and if we can avoid it from becoming violent and basically another civil war, because that was another one of the revolutionary periods in the United States. And a lot of people died in that one. I don't want to see that happen again. But if we can go through this and make this country a better and more egalitarian country, you know, for many of the countries of Europe, what it took for them was just being basically occupied by Nazis or bombed back to the Stone Age, for them to make that reboot. I'm hoping that, and for us, we rebooted our country real significantly with the Civil War when we flushed slavery out of our bloodstream to some extent. I mean, you know, legally anyway, yeah. Much of it. And now we've got to flush basically the banksters out of our bloodstream. And how we're going to do that, exactly how it's going to be done, you know, we all have suggestions and ideas, but I'm telling you, these young people who are out in the streets and the old people who are out there with them, increasingly what you're seeing is that it's the young people and their parents. It's the boomers are showing up along with the current generation and some of the folks from the generations in between, although a lot of them are in their child rearing years and in their working years. And if they have a job, you know, they're not showing up. But I think that this is a revolutionary and transformational moment. Larry, thank you. You said it very, very well. And, spot on. Leo in Boston. Hey, Leo, what's up?
Hi. Yeah, I'm glad to finally get on. I was wondering, are we dealing with the situation here in the Occupy Wall Street that various groups are trying to co-opt it? And, I mean, I've heard...
Of course.
Pardon?
Of course. Any successful movement, everybody's going to try and get in on it. When Martin Luther King's nonviolent civil rights movement became large and popular, suddenly the unions were jumping in on it. And 10, 15 years before, they'd been largely opposing it because they didn't want to see their workforces diluted. Everybody's going to try and take their piece of this.
In light of 1984... and A Brave New World, I'm really surprised. See, I went up to the Lawrence Labor Day Festival,
mm-hmm.
spoke to the different people in the different booths, and I said, do you have any books about abolishing the UK monarchy? And it seemed like that wasn't a primary source, because I'm beginning to think that these socialists are owned by the UK monarchs, and that's why they can't write books about abolishing them.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about that?
No, I think the UK monarchs have been largely marginalized in the UK and have, you know, I'm not one of those who subscribes to the conspiracy theory that the British royal family runs the world. I think the British royal family runs Buckingham Palace. That's pretty much it. So anyway, we'll leave it at that. We'll come back with more of the conversation in just a moment. The Occupy movement. Oh, and we still haven't gotten to apples and oranges. And, of course, Talk Radio News is going to check in with us and let us know what's going on today here in Washington, D.C., in the places of phony poll.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In the places of the phony baloney power, the places of real power are in the streets right now. They really, really, truly are.
You got no time for the messenger. Got no regard for the thing that you don't understand. You got no fear of the underdog. That's why you will not survive.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen Ratner's efforts to bring some peace and stability to small communities in southern Sudan. Victoria Jones, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. So what's going on here in D.C. and around the world?
Well, we're starting on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Not with Occupy Wall Street, but with Wall Street, where Citigroup today agreed to pay $285 million to settle charges that it misled investors in a $1 billion derivatives deal tied to the United States housing market. Then it bet against investors as the housing market began to show signs of distress, according to the Securities and Exchange Commission.
So
they also brought, they were very naughty.
Yeah, and I think we all know about that. You know, Carl Levin reading his unmentionable on the radio memos, you know, from although I think that was either from Merrill Lynch or I think that was Merrill. It might have been Goldman Sachs. But in any case, we know that that happened. Is the amount of the fine that they paid, did they pay that to the government? Secondly, does it equal the amount of profit that they made, or is it less than? And third, are any of the people that they screwed being made whole?
The money is going to the investors.
Okay, so the people who got harmed are being made whole. Is it an amount of money equal to the amount of the harm, or is it a token?
Well, my understanding from what I'm seeing from the New York Times, which is all I have so far, is it was a $1 billion deal, and the settlement is $285 million. So it doesn't sound like the sum of the whole.
Yeah, okay.
But it's something.
Yeah.
Well, what I have here is that, and this gives, it tells you a bit of the story too, is that Citigroup exercised significant influence over the selection of $500 million of assets in the deal's portfolio. So then they're paying $285 million. Then they took a short position against the mortgage-related assets, an investment in which they would profit if the assets declined in value. And, this is even naughtier, they didn't disclose to the investors to whom they sold the collateralized debt obligation that they'd helped to select the assets or that they were betting against them.
Right.
And interestingly, the rules state that they have to, quote, deal fairly with all persons. That is the rule.
Yeah. So that's the rule that they broke.
Didn't.
Yeah.
I find
it interesting that a rule requires fairness. That's kind of cool.
Well, that is what is contended by some. Now, there are others who will contend that it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to disclose everything to everybody in an affirmative way.
Mm.
This is in some dispute.
Yeah.
But it does state in the rule, deal fairly with all persons.
Okay.
So I think that's interesting. Anyway, they've agreed. However, they are not admitting that they necessarily admit or deny the charges.
Right. You know, it's amazing how many of these corporations have been convicted of felonies, and yet they still are allowed to continue operating. If you or I were convicted of a felony, we'd be in prison. But in this case, they get to say, oh, yeah, we did something wrong. Here's $200 million. By the way, we're not even going to admit that we did something wrong. It's bizarre. It's bizarre.
Exactly.
Okay. Moving along.
Meantime, the Super Committee is meeting up with the Gang of Six today. You might call it a mob squad.
Wait a minute. The Gang of 12 is meeting the Gang of Six? What Gang of Six?
The old Gang of Six.
Oh, the old voluntary We're Going to Get Together Gang of Six is now meeting with the Gang of 12 that was mandated by congressional legislation.
Right, so it's sort of 18. So I'm calling it sort of a mob squad
right.
of 18.
Okay, the A team and the B team.
So if you remember, the Gang of Six actually came up with $3.7 trillion in savings, which nobody ever took any notice of. So they could teach the super committee a thing or two. And they were thinking, there were rumors that this meeting was going to take place in public. Actually, it's going to take place behind closed doors.
Of course.
Also, we should note that the 12-member committee is actually just halfway through the 76-day interval from its first meeting to the date its final report is due on November the 23rd. According to the Washington Post, which has done quite a lot of research on this, has talked a little bit to the members, but they're not talking, and has talked to everybody on Capitol Hill who's talked to them. It hasn't gained much traction or got very much done because nobody's budging on anything. Republicans won't move on taxes, and Democrats won't move on entitlement programs like Medicare unless Republicans move on taxes. And apparently, nobody will really move on anything until they get very much guidance. Barney Frank says, these 12 people are no more autonomous than your left thumb. They need some guidance from the White House and from the leadership of Congress. Yeah. Orrin Hatch saying, my impression, they're not progressing too rapidly. Things are not moving too fast. Somebody else saying, everybody's sitting around sucking their thumb until they get some guidance on what to do. And it's interesting because these 12 were chosen and given autonomy, and yet apparently they're not acting in that way.
Well, could that be because they know that whatever comes out is going to be submitted for a vote, and they're going to have a majority of votes in both the House and Senate?
I think they know that, and I think also because these 12 are all loyal soldiers, and they were all chosen because they are loyal to the leadership.
Yeah. Is the leadership of either party, and is the White House offering any guidance? Have they up to this point, or are they all saying, oh, wait a minute, it's your problem?
Well, at the beginning, they weren't saying anything, and everyone was saying, oh, this is great. They've got autonomy. They can really get down to it and come up with something creative.
Right.
And then if you remember, the speaker said, no new taxes. And then the president stepped in and said, well, there shouldn't be cuts to entitlements.
Right.
And then everybody said, well, then they've been hamstrung.
Yeah. So they're not only not getting guidance, they're getting anti-guidance.
I think that's fair to say.
Remarkable. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great getting our news reports from Victoria Jones. Up next, we're going to be talking a little bit more about what happened last night, and James Hoffa is going to be here.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program, Exposing the Con in Conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement, the 99% movement, not speaking on behalf of or for them at all in any way, because, you know, everybody is very clear that this is, at least at this moment, a purely grassroots, leaderless, there's no Koch brothers behind this. There's no Dick Armey and company behind this. But protesting, in my opinion, in large part, the ripoff of jobs, safety, and environmental standards in the United States. I mean, you know, all this stuff is going overseas, or, you know, our country is crumbling, and it's ongoing, and there's another one that's happening right now. James Hoffa, the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, is going to be holding a press conference this afternoon with Congressman Duncan Hunter, the Republican from California, and Bob Filner, the Democrat from California, at the Mexican border at Otay Mesa to talk about something that the Department of Transportation is up to. James Hoffa, Teamster.org, of course, is the website. Welcome back to our program.
Tom, it's good to be back.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. tell us, what's the DOT up to? What the hell's going on down on our southern border here with regard to trucking?
Well, you wouldn't believe it that, for over 20 years, the border's been closed, and because there isn't the same qualifications for drivers and equipment coming out of Mexico. We're very strict with our drivers here. They got to have a CDL. They got to have the right to, trucks have to be inspected. People have to have physicals, drug testing, and all that. They have to keep logbooks.
A CDL is a commercial driver's license, right?
Commercial driver's license. Right. So now this administration and the DOT is, after spending over $800 million so far, are hell bent on opening this border and bringing these unsafe trucks across the border, and it's going to again lose jobs for American truck drivers, American warehousemen, but most importantly, it's going to endanger the American driving public. And what I'm going to say in my press conference is, they're playing Russian roulette with people's lives by letting these trucks on.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing story because, they go through all this. They say, we're being very careful. We're vetting these different trucks. And the first thing they did was, okay, here's a list of the trucks that have been let in. And we find a truck that's 20 years old that's been ruled off the highway four times, and they embarrassingly took it out of service and said, okay, that one won't be considered. If it wasn't for the Teamsters and it wasn't for, the congressmen and the Independent Drivers Association, this would have slipped through.
Wow.
So if we're catching this, what do you think is out there that we're not catching?
Right. And
basically,
now
this is basically the same stuff. We're going to open this border no matter what, no matter who gets hurt, no matter how many jobs are lost. It's working fine now, but what they want to do is to basically start this race to the bottom because they don't want to pay the rates of regular truck drivers, whether they're a union or non-union. And
They
get some kind of a bargain rate by hiring people from Mexico.
And you pointed out this: the Obama administration is promoting this policy, but the whole NAFTA-CAFTA-SHAFTA thing long predates President Obama. I'm curious if this is something that the administration is, particularly enthusiastic about and pushing, or is this just institutional inertia? Did this start, back during the Clinton or Ford or earlier Bush administration or even Reagan administration, and it's just had this momentum to keep momentum, I guess is the word, not inertia, to keep going, or has there been some new? I mean, what's going on?
Well, we basically shut it down. Bush tried the same pilot program, and we embarrassed him into basically doing the same thing, finding trucks with 25 violations, trucks that were unsafe, drivers that were untrained, and eventually we went to Congress and we had the whole thing defunded. The only way we could stop Bush was to fund it, and in the House it was voted down 411-3. In the Senate, 75-23, we got it defunded. Now, that was Bush.
Right.
So, to say that I'm surprised that the Obama administration turns right around and comes back with this program all over again after it's been proven that it's dangerous, it's bad for the environment, it's already cost our government over $750 million just screwing around with this thing, and it's just going on. I call it the zombie bill.
Yeah.
No matter how many times I kill it, it keeps coming back.
It seems.
It's a zombie. You watch those movies with the zombies.
Yeah. So is this?
So anyway, we really have a battle on our hands. But I'll tell you what I think is behind it. Number one, it's the big companies that have moved across the border, that have laid off Americans, that have their operations. Ford, General Electric, Caterpillar, everybody.
Building factories in Mexico to sell products into the United States. Yeah.
Now stuff in cheap, and they want to do it even cheaper so they can put the money in their pockets.
Yeah.
And they've really gotten to Calderon, who's the head of the government of Mexico. And, I think that there's a lot of things about, we want to have good relationships with Mexico. Mexico really wants this. And, we don't give a damn about the public. We're going to do it no matter what. That's where it's coming from.
That's
tragic. It's the old story, Tom. When you can't figure it out, money.
Yeah, follow the money. We're talking with James Hoffa, the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, teamster.org. Is the solution to this for us to call our members of Congress and say stop this, or to call the White House? Has legislation already been passed to allow this, or is there legislation in the pipeline to block this? I mean, where do we go from here?
Well, Duncan Hunter and Peter DeFazio have already introduced legislation to stop this. So we're going to make sure, I hope that that gets stopped, so we can stop this insanity once again.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it has a lot of inertia. I mean, they're pushing so hard to open the border to get, you know, these trucks coming in. We keep on blowing it up by, you know, number one, finding out how poor these trucks are. This one truck was, you know, was pathetic. And, you know, it's just another fiasco by the administration trying to push this too fast.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing is every study shows, even their own studies, which are done by their own attorney, you know, internal investigation, shows that their trucks don't meet our standards. And the drivers are not trained. They don't keep logbooks. They don't have physicals. There's no drug testing like there is with regard to American truck drivers. And I got a joke. It's incredible about the drug testing. We went to a Senate hearing or a House hearing, and we asked them, okay, how are you going to do these drug tests down in Mexico?
Right.
And they admitted that in all of Mexico, this is hard to believe, there isn't one drug testing facility.
You're kidding.
So I said, okay, if there's nothing to do that, how are you going to test these drugs? Well, we're going to fly them to the United States and have them tested.
And then fly them back home and hope
fly
that...
Fly them back. I mean, it's such a joke. I mean, you have to have... You're supposed to have, you know, basically a custody line with regard to how it is.
Sure.
And they even take the temperature of your urine.
Yeah.
And this stuff could be a German Shepherd.
Right, right. And they do that to make sure that it just came out of your body and not from a plastic bag you carried in. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So Duncan Hunter, the right-wing Republican, and Peter DeFazio, one of the most progressive Democrats in the House of Representatives, one of the best guys, in my opinion, in the House of Representatives, have introduced...
And also Bob Filner, too.
And Bob Filner, another good Democrat, great guy, have introduced legislation to put a stop to this. And this is one of those moments when I think Republicans and Democrats across the country can say, this isn't a partisan issue, this is an American issue.
Well, I agree with you, and I think it's an issue of our highways, of everything we believe in, and basically, you know, there can't be a double standard. If there's going to be one standard for American truck drivers, that should apply to everybody. Isn't it amazing we have no problem with Canada? They have the same standards up there. The Canadian drivers come over here, and no one says anything.
Yeah.
But when it comes to Mexico, they're not even close. They don't even have a database, you know, the comprehensive database. You know, that if you get a ticket somewhere or you kill somebody with your truck, that somebody knows about it and it's in a database.
Incredible.
We have that in the United States. If you get, you know, a ticket anywhere in the United States, it goes on
right.
your record in your state.
That's right.
They don't have that.
That's amazing. James Hoffa, General President, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Teamsters Audit. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Remarkable. I you know, I find it amazing that the admin, you know, I'm just astounded. Anyhow. We'll be right back.
So baby, if you're good to go, we'll go down to Mexico and get a place in Cabo. Kick back in the sand. If you get off that telephone and put your shorts and sandals on, tomorrow we'll be dancing to the mariachi band.
I got to tell you, you know, whether it's our commercial stations who are supported by selling commercials, commercial enterprises, or our Pacifica stations, who are in many cases are also supported by commercial enterprises, you know, doing underwriting statements as opposed to full form commercials. But and even our television affiliates and whatnot. That, you know, there's some companies and some nice, really small companies behind all this. And I just want to shout out that there's a company in Seattle that decided to advertise on our Seattle affiliate. We've been on KPTK AM 1090 in Seattle for years and years and years, and carrying our program live, and we're very grateful for it. And one of the things that I say to all of my radio stations is that if you have a local advertiser, and by the way, if you happen to be listening right now and you own a business and you're listening on a radio station, and you're thinking, hey, I'd like to get my message out, radio is the most cost-efficient way to do that. And so I've always said, you know, I will voice spots for any of our local affiliates, and I don't charge for it. No charge. Please do it. You know, just and in fact, every day when we get off the air, Jacob and I record two or three spots for various stations. We get stations all over the country that that do this. But this one particular company, brand new, that you know, they just started advertising with Talk 1090. It's called Petapalooza in Seattle. Pet, P-E-T-A, Palooza, P-O-L-U-Z-A, which is, by the way, their website, petapalooza.com. They, you know, I voiced some spots for them, and as a thank you, I guess, in fact, I know it is, they sent a care package and a thank you note for my crazy cat Higgins, our attack cat. And we have two other cats. Louise has two cats, I have Higgins. And, yeah. And, you know, cats are not vegetarians. So they sent along a bunch of stuff, including some freeze-dried bunnies. You know, rabbit pieces, basically. I'm assuming. I don't know. Maybe it's something else, but it's called freeze-dried bunnies. And Higgins just went nuts. And there was a toy in there that Mowgli, another one of our cats, is. You know, when we went to bed, he was chasing the thing around. So anyhow, thank you for the acknowledgement. And it's absolutely not necessary. In fact, I do not want to start an avalanche of people sending us anything because we get too much stuff as it is. But it was just. It was sweet, and I wanted to thank you for that, but also I wanted to make sure that if you are thinking, if you have a small business and you'd like to get your message out and you're hearing my voice on a local radio station, whether it's a for-profit station where you can buy an advertisement or whether it's one of our Pacifica stations where you can do an underwriting statement, if you want me to voice it, be pleased to help out. Just, you know, contact your local station and let them know, and they know how to get in touch with us, and we go from there. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, and lots going on. We will get back to apples and oranges and Mitt Romney in just a moment, but Charles in Belton, Missouri is on the line. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I really like Free Speech TV. One of the questions I had, I'm a former combat veteran. I went to Fallujah and served in the Lombard province.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I see the people in the media talking about everybody on Wall Street and how some of the people out there are ignorant and they don't know what they're doing. They don't really have a point. And then they complain, and, you know, you got the guy who's saying, you know, that it's their fault that they don't have a job. But now it transfers from the real estate bubble that crashed our economy, or part of the reason our economy crashed, and we're moving into this college bubble now, where the for-profit colleges like the Art Institute and other places like that are funneling this government money, the Pell Grants, and they keep raising the prices of tuition every
yes.
year. And finally, when you finally get your bachelor's degree and get out of school, there's no jobs for you because everyone is going to college right now. So
yeah.
it's just really confusing because nobody seems to be doing anything or trying to put regulations in on the colleges and how much they can charge. Every year for the past 10 years, it's gone up, you know,
yep.
almost $20,000, $30,000. And it's getting kind of ridiculous. And, you know, I was wondering what your thoughts were on that. Do you think that they could maybe change the concept or maybe throw in some regulations in there to make the tuition?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think we've moved from bubble to bubble. About 4 months ago, we did an hour on this show because that was the day that student debt in the United States exceeded credit card debt. So you've got a relatively small group of mostly younger people whose aggregate debt is greater than the debt of all the credit card holders in the United States, over $1 trillion now. And what are they getting for that? Screwed. You know, that's the bottom line. They're getting basically nothing for it. Yesterday when we were in New York, Louise and I had dinner with one of my oldest and longest best friends, Jerry Schneiderman and Lily and his wife. And Jerry went to Baruch College in New York and back 30 years ago and for free. And he said, and he made the comment over dinner. He said, you know, what I got, I got a free college education. What I got is just basically no longer available. It's like, you know, and you know, Louise worked her way through college working as a waitress at the Howard Johnson's. You can't do that anymore. It's too expensive. And, you know, I worked at Bob's Big Boys. I spun records at WVIC, and I worked weekends in a gas station replacing tires and pumping gas. And one summer I picked apples up in White Cloud, Michigan, you know, to make money to pay for college tuition. And you could make, you know, the summer of work, you could pay for a year's worth of college. You can't do that anymore. So, yeah, we need to reboot the whole thing. And the guy who started the idea of free college education in the United States was Thomas Jefferson with the University of Virginia, the nation's first free college. The guy who expanded it dramatically was Abraham Lincoln, who started the land-grant college system, which was like MSU, where my mother actually graduated from. And those have all kind of gone the way of being expensive. We need to go back to free college in this country, which all ended with Reagan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up next, the good, the bad, and the insanely ugly. And do you get a bushel of apples with oranges or not? Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very albescently ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good, Skane's Yarn Store. As New Zealand copes with a devastating oil spill, there are thousands of oil-slicked penguins in need of help, and Skeins is there to do just that. The store is knitting mini penguin sweaters to keep the birds warm until they're well enough to be cleaned and to prevent the birds from plucking out all of their oil-soaked feathers. So far, there are numerous sweater designs, pink and purple turtlenecks, tuxedo pattern sweaters, to even Charlie Brown-looking sweaters. Skeins is calling on others to lend their knitting skills to make even more penguin sweaters for the affected birds. Job well done. The bad. Executives at Goldman Sachs. The bank reported a loss of $428 million in the third quarter of this year, almost a half a billion, since its second loss since going public in 1999. However, through the first 9 months of the year, Goldman also set aside $10 billion. Keep in mind, they lost about half a billion dollars. They set aside $10 billion in compensation funds, mostly to cut fat checks to executives like Lloyd Blankfein, who took home $13 million last year. That means that if Goldman had only set aside $9.5 billion to compensate their fat cats this year, the company would have been profitable last quarter. But as the Wall Street culture goes, banksters get their millions regardless of whether or not their company is making money. Once again, heads they win, tails everyone else loses. And the very, very ugly Pat Buchanan. He wrote an op-ed for CNSNews.com to hype his new book, Suicide of a Superpower. The premise of his book and the premise of his op-ed is that America is in decline. No, not because of failed supply-side economics and Reaganomics, but instead because, in Pat's world, the end of the white race. Being overtly racist, Buchanan writes about immigration, quote, "The majority of immigrants and illegals come from third world countries and do not bring the academic or professional skills of European Americans." He then goes on to write, "The decline in academic test scores here at home and in international competition is likely to continue as more and more of these children taking these tests will be African American and Hispanic," end quote. Wow, pretty harsh. So much for America being the great melting pot. I guess Pat Buchanan only likes white vegetables in his soup. And that's very, very, very ugly. It's really, you know, quite amazing. I got to go beyond that. Steve in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Here in Orlando, we had an Occupy Orlando last Saturday. It was great. There was like 3,000 people. And one of the speakers was a former leader of the local Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. He actually did a lousy job getting Democrats elected. But anyway, my concern, especially when you said, you know, on the news that the New York City General Assembly wanted delegates from each congressional district,
right,
is that I don't want the Democratic Party to co-opt the Occupy movement. I mean, I'm not going to vote Republican, but I don't want the Democrats.
If anything, it should be the other way around.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that the Occupy movement should become the force, the power that influences the Democratic Party to fundamentally change, the same way the civil rights movement changed the Democratic Party 40 years ago.
I'm with you. That would be great. I'm worried that Obama isn't listening.
Well, I think he is. And although, frankly, he's not going to be able to do anything until after the election because the Republicans are going to block anything he does. And we're seeing that right up front. And I mean, you know, we had a former Republican congressman on the show a couple days ago, Friday. Bernie Sanders, you know, brought him on, our Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood. He's a Republican, registered Republican. And when asked, you know, what's the Republican strategy? What, you know, what are they doing? He was like, you know, their strategy is to block anything that Obama tries to do. So, but that's the whole politics thing and the Democratic Party thing. But the reality is, if you look at the history of movements, whether it was the movement to prohibit the sale of alcohol or the movement to end prohibition, whether it was the movement to end legal discrimination, the civil rights movement, or the movement for women to have equal pay for equal work, which is still ongoing, by the way. I mean, we still haven't gotten there. We still don't have really full civil rights in this country. But still, if you look at any of these movements, the movement to abolish slavery, the movement, frankly, to separate us from England in the 1770s. If you look at any of these movements historically, what you find is that there were political institutions in place at the time that typically were either shocked, horrified, or outright opposed those movements. And then as the movements got large enough and big enough that they were impossible to ignore, the political institutions embraced them and said, oh, yeah, no, this is our movement. This is how the Tea Party took control of the Republican Party. And frankly, I think that if the Occupy movement plays its cards right, and I'm not trying to offer advice. I'm not sure what that would look like. But you know, my guess is it would be like the civil rights movement. In other words, stay nonviolent. Stay on message. Don't go, you know, and you know, don't go over the top. Don't give them an excuse to call you the bad guys or the crazies. And just stay on message. The system is broken. The system is corrupt. It needs to be fixed. Those kinds of things. If they play their cards right, they will transform the Democratic Party, just like the Tea Party transformed the Republican Party. So when I see,
do you feel there's been any co-opting of let's say Move On or some of the other groups? I mean, I don't think it's been the 21st Century Democrats or the Democracy of America, but I'm worried about maybe Move On or some of the others. What do you think?
Well, I Move On is one of many groups that have come out, and along with the unions, for example, who have come out and said, and we just had earlier in the program, we had a woman on from National Nurses United. They're setting up tents in the occupied cities to provide free health care. Now, you could say, hey, that's them trying to hook their wagon to the star of a movement that's really rising. Or
no,
you could
that's
say
part of the movement,
that's
so.
Exactly. Or you could say that's them becoming part of the movement. And I think that what happens, and again, just looking at history, this is what you see, is that what happens is that those people who, when you have a strong social movement and people who represent institutional power or institutions step into that movement thinking that they're going to get some of that mojo, they end up being co-opted by the movement, not the other way around. It's very rare that, you know, sometimes it takes a long time. I mean, you know, the civil rights movement or the anti-slavery movement took a long, long time. Go back and read some of John Quincy Adams's speeches after he left the presidency and went back into the House of Representatives to fight against slavery in the 1830s. Absolutely brilliant stuff. But what you see is that sometimes these are multi-generational battles. I mean, you know, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton in the 1870s, I think it was 1874, November of 1874, when Susan B. Anthony voted and got arrested for it and you know, kind of kicked that thing off. Well, she didn't live to see the success of her movement, but her movement eventually co-opted a political party and an entire nation that thought it could co-opt
the movement. I would like to see that, you know, I would like not to die before this.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And I think things are happening much faster now than they were back in the last century for obvious reasons. You know, this is why, you know, it used to be when the president was elected in November, he was sworn in March, and they moved that up to January because, you know, you no longer have to ride by horseback, you know, across America to get to Washington, D.C. to get sworn in. And, you know, now we've got instant communications and all these kinds of things. So I think things are happening much more rapidly. And I really believe that the next 2 or 3 years are going to see a fundamental transformation of this country. And it is starting with the Occupy movements, and it's going to move up through all of these other institutions. And there will be people who will, you know, freak out and go, oh, my God, we're being co-opted. Look at this. You know, MoveOn.org is sending out a letter in our support. How can that be? Well, the fact of the matter is that they are being influenced by the movement. You know, MoveOn.org in, at some points in their past has been a little more establishment, and this is a very anti-establishment movement. And so I think it's a great thing that they're tossing in with it. All of them, I mean, personally, I,
well,
just speaking for myself.
Alan Grayson was there, and he was great also.
Yeah, and he's running for Congress. He's running for Congress, and what Alan Grayson has always, I mean, I would say Alan Grayson's always been part of the movement. But, you know, I know that there are purists within the movement, and I remember this, you know, from SDS when I was in that, you know, long gone far away, that there are always going to be people who say, oh no, we're the pure ones. We're the, you know, we're the ideologues. We're the holders of the dogma. We're the only ones who know. And all these other people who have been working in politics for years and years, or who have been working in movement, you know, organizations, they are the carpetbaggers and whatnot. And, you know, what you end up with inevitably in movements is, you know, fracturing and infighting and whatnot. But, you know, hopefully it'll be minimized here, and hopefully things will move forward in a positive direction. But frankly, I'm not at all worried about the movement being co-opted by the parties. I'm quite certain that the parties and the organizations, even the grassroots organizations that have become relatively institutional, like MoveOn, in other words, they've developed a structure out of what was originally just a, you know, a bunch of people in their living rooms with email, that those organizations are going to be co-opted is the wrong word, but, you know, influenced by, brought into the sphere of, adopt the politics of, become part of this greater movement. And as that happens, then, you know, then it becomes, you know, viral across the United States. That's when the movement, the old, in advertising, the series was called Early Adopters, Early Mass Market, Middle Mass Market, you know, and then laggards. You know, there's this whole axiom in marketing. And you could
thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate the call, Steve. Not only would I not worry about it, I'd be excited about it. And the Occupy Wall Street folks were the early adopters, and now it's moving into the early mass market. That is, that it is becoming part of the gestalt of the mainstream. And that's a really actually good thing, because that's when it hits critical mass and change happens.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, financial crimes, are they worse now or not? And the shipping industry versus the trucking industry. Right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy.
Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain, although it does not lead to stiff thinking. And don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. Robert in Columbia, Maryland. Hey, Robert, you've got an update on the Occupy DC movement and the arrest of Cornel West?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thanks
hey,
for having me on again.
Sure.
I just got back home yesterday after 5 days and five nights in Occupy DC, McPherson.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very interesting 5 days. Yeah, the highlight was definitely the arrest of Cornel West and 19 others at the Supreme Court building, protesting Citizens United versus the FEC. And it was amazing. It was amazing.
Cornel West is now out of jail, and the arrests have stopped, and McPherson Square is still being occupied?
Yes, that action was on Sunday, and they were released Monday, 24 hours later.
Right.
And I was also at that, at the arraignment release. It was shocking. It was just unbelievable. Cornel West said in 24 hours they weren't provided any food. Each person was given one bottle of water while being held.
In a 24-hour period, one bottle of water, no food?
Correct.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
It was shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay. Well, Robert, thank you for the update.
Another thing about the National Nurses United.
Yes, sir.
I was at the AFL-CIO headquarters on Monday as one of the persons representing Occupy DC McPherson with three other people, and I had a conversation with National Nurses United, and they're a wonderful bunch of people.
They are. They absolutely are. They get it, and they get it that, oddly enough, it's taking a group of nurses from the medical profession to tell us how bad the financial profession is, you know, how bad Wall Street is. But they totally get it, and they've got a great lobbying campaign or campaign going on to wake us all up to that. Robert, thank you for the call. Thanks for the updates. Keep them coming. Much appreciated. Hal in Clear Lake, California. Hey, Hal, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for that last musical break, by the way. I wish you'd have gone a little longer.
Oh, yeah. Leonard Cohen is great. Hal, if we're on a speakerphone, could you please pick it up? Because it's awful hard to hear you right now.
Let's see. I'll get off the speakerphone.
There we go. Nope. Okay. I think we lost Hal.
No, I'm still here. Can you hear me better now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Infinitely better.
All right. Sorry about that.
That's okay. No, I understand it. When you're waiting on hold, I understand. It's just, you know, once you go on the air, it sounds like, you know.
Shaving, too, by the way. What I first said was thank you for that last musical break. I wish you would let it go a little longer. It's a great song.
Yeah.
What I wanted to talk to you about was something that's being touched upon here and there relative to the Occupy movement and some of the demands that they're putting out and Tea Party movement. And there's a lot of places where it crosses over.
Sure.
I'd love to hear more conversation about how we can bridge the gap between these two seemingly disparate movements, but in some way really united, because at the base, it's tapping into the same anger and discontent.
Right. They're both populist movements. We've tried on this program to get some of the Tea Party folks that we've had on the program in the past to come on, but they have typically, you know, the Tea Party is organized in a at least the official face of the Tea Party is organized in a fairly hierarchical fashion. Ultimately, most of it answers to Dick Armey and the Koch brothers and whatnot. And those folks don't want to come on and say that they have any common cause. And finding just average Tea Partiers, I don't have like a list, you know, so that I could call up. But we have had a number of people.
Leadership at all, because I don't believe their leadership really represents people in this country.
No, their leadership is lobbyists.
With any of them,
you know, Dick Armey is a multimillionaire lobbyist. He's the leader of the Tea Party. But what we have had is a lot of people call this program over the last few weeks saying they showed up at Tea Party events. They considered themselves Tea Partiers because they were mad as hell and didn't want to take it anymore. They didn't really understand exactly where the problem was, but they knew that there was a problem and that they were very concerned about it. And now the Occupy Wall Street movement is helping them realize that the problem is the top 1%. If you look, there's a great piece over at thinkprogress.org, and I don't know if it originated there or not, but they've got the graphs there where they talk about how before the Occupy Wall Street movement, the word jobless or unemployed or unemployment was, they've got these two graphs, and it was like, 1%. I mean, it was it mentions in the corporate media, in the mainstream media, basically the television networks, you know, the big television networks. It was virtually never mentioned. But the debt of the United States was being constantly mentioned, because that's the Grover Norquist, you know, Koch brothers excuse to slash social programs. Now, as a result of the Occupy Wall Street movement, the joblessness in the United States has surpassed the debt of the United States as the main topic that's being discussed in the corporate media. And I see that as an incredible victory.
That's a very positive motion forward there. One other thing, and I'll let you take some more callers. You said that when these mass movements are too big to ignore, I wouldn't categorize it in quite that fashion. I would say that when the mass movements begin to compel the institutions of the country.
Yes.
And that's the kind of different way of thinking than too big to ignore, although it gets to the same place.
Yeah. In fact, I would say when they begin to shame the big institutions. I mean, that's what the civil rights movement did when they stood there and let them turn the fire hoses and the dogs on them. They shamed the institutions. And, you know, we'll see how this all plays out. But you're right, Hal. You're right. It is, and it is an important distinction. Thanks for the call. Coming up tomorrow, journalist Ron Suskind will be here with his observations on the issues in his latest book, Confidence Men. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.